Good afternoon and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call on Turkey and the Turkish elections that were held last week. I'm Shoshana Bryan, the Senior Director of the JPC. I know some people's eyeballs are falling out today from watching Israeli election returns late last night, but I also know that this audience understands the importance of Turkey, whether it's as a good ally to the U.S. and the West or as an impediment to Western interests. The election there was not exactly what Prime Minister Erdogan was expecting or hoping for, and it may be proved to be a harbinger of changes in Turkey. Before I introduce our speaker, a man whose knowledge of Turkey and its government are second to none in Washington, let me do one important housekeeping thing. There's no open microphone on this call. To ask a question, please email it to us at info@jewishpolicycenter.org or tweet us at the JPC. We'll be monitoring the questions as they come in. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Aykan Erdemir, Senior Fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and a former member of the Turkish Parliament. In Parliament, he served in the EU-Turkey Joint Parliamentary Committee, the EU Harmonization Committee, and the Ad Hoc Parliamentary Committee on the IT Sector and the Internet. As an outspoken defender of pluralism, minority rights, and religious freedoms in the Middle East, Aykan has been at the forefront of the struggle against religious persecution, hate crimes, and hate speech in Turkey. He's a founding member of the International Panel of Parliamentarians for Freedom of Religion or Belief and a drafter of and signatory to the Oslo Charter for Freedom of Religion or Belief, as well as a signatory legislator to the London Declaration on Combating Antisemitism. He is a Harvard MA and PhD. In 2015, he was awarded a distinguished fellowship at the Oxford Center for the Study of Law and Public Policy. And in 2016, awarded the Stefanus Prize for Religious Freedom. We are very pleased to have you with us today, Aykan Erdemir, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Shoshana and the JPC, for this kind invitation. It's a great pleasure to be addressing this distinguished crowd, especially with some rare good news from Turkey. I know the results of the Turkish elections are mixed at best, and there are still many unknowns as some recounts continue, as there are further legal and extra-legal challenges by Turkey's strongman Erdogan, and there is still the possibility that some of the elected mayors could be removed from office to be replaced by appointed and handpicked loyalists of Erdogan. But nevertheless, I think both the election results and their potential repercussions deserve a closer look. And I will try to give you a quick overview within the next 15 minutes, and then we can have a Q&A. First, to set the scene, let me begin by arguing that, you know, in Turkey's long history of free and fair elections, at least since 1950, this was an exception. The elections were neither fair nor fully free. So I would call it not fair, but partially free elections. And what do I mean by that? You know, over 90% of the Turkish media is now controlled by President Erdogan and his cronies. There are studies showing that a vast majority of the airtime were dedicated to the ruling alliance of Islamists, the AKP, as well as its ultra-nationalist partners, the MHP. And the opposition had very little airtime, and most of that time happened to be critical coverage of the opposition parties and candidates. Then quite a number of the pro-Kurdish HDP politicians were in prison. You know, over 100 mayors were already removed since the last local elections to be replaced by trustees. There are scores of, you know, lawmakers, mayors, city councillors, province and sub-province chairs and board members of the HDP in jail, as well as a handful of the main opposition pro-secular CHP's politicians in jail. And third, there were repeated threats by President Erdogan, the interior, and his interior minister that if the electorate, you know, goes and elects opposition mayors in a number of cities, including Ankara, as well as in, you know, predominantly Kurdish districts, they, you know, openly threatened that they would remove these mayors from office, they would take them to court and replace them with caretakers, with trustees. And this was also as part of an overall attempt to criminalize the entire opposition. You know, in pro-government media, we had the entire front pages dedicated to listing, you know, hundreds of opposition candidates arguing that they're all terrorists, you know, linked to the PKK as well as to FETÖ, which is the Fethullahist terrorist organization, the Gülenist movement in Turkey, which has, since their fallout with Erdogan, has been criminalized. So in this very extreme of circumstances, the opposition contested the elections. Now, what resulted in this kind of unforeseen, unexpected victory for the opposition, and when I mean victory, I basically refer to the fact that the opposition won 8 of the 12 largest cities. They now control over 2/3 of the economic activity in Turkey and over more than half the population in Turkey. Now, it is true that Erdogan and his ultra-nationalist allies still received over 50% of the vote. They still, you know, control vast, you know, territory in central Turkish plateau. But I think what really matters is who won these large concentration of economic activity and population. And if you take such a look at the local elections, it's an unequivocal victory for the opposition. You know, Erdogan's control of the Turkish GDP through the municipalities have come down from, you know, almost 3/4 to 1/4. So this is a massive loss for Erdogan. And you might wonder, how was this possible, you know, given the uneven playing field in Turkey? And that has a lot to do with a number of factors. First, the opposition managed to show, especially the pro-secular CHP managed to show catch-all candidates that appealed both to Turkey's center-right and to center-left, and both to Turks and Kurds, as well as both to Sunnis and Alevis. Second, this time around, the opposition had a very positive messaging, whereas Erdogan was basically trying to smear the opposition. He had very little to deliver in terms of positive messaging, having exhausted all that messaging. Third, the opposition, again, unexpectedly managed to put together a very strong ballot box organization. In earlier elections, there was a lot of ballot box rigging, especially at the level of counting and tallying of votes and reporting of votes. And the opposition failed again and again. And this time around, at least in major cities, the opposition seems to have gotten its act together. And they showed a resilience in pushing back against Erdogan's attempts to rig, you know, the ballots. But there is one factor without which none of this would have been possible. You know, as a social scientist, I hate explaining, you know, social and political developments with a single variable. But in this case, that single variable has been key, and that is a brilliant, masterful chess move by the jailed former leader of the pro-Kurdish HDP. In the last few days of the elections, from his Twitter account, he was able to share one message to his followers, and he said, "I know you're heartbroken, but I beg you to go to the polls and vote for opposition candidates in the western part of Turkey, because the pro-Kurdish HDP only ran with candidates in predominantly Kurdish provinces, and they had this brilliant strategy of not nominating candidates in the West, and they managed to mobilize predominantly Kurdish voters and their progressive allies in the West to vote for the main opposition, CHP, and its ally, center-right E-parties candidates. Now, there were many skeptics that this could have been pulled off at the ballot box because there is so much that disconnects CHP's center-right and moderately nationalist partner EE and now tactical partner HDP from one another. And I guess most people assume that there was no way in which these three distinct political traditions could come together at the ballot box. And I think besides the brilliant kind of chess move by the HDP's imprisoned former leader, there was also another push factor, and that was Erdogan and his ultra-nationalist ally Bahçeli's mistaken framing of the elections. They consistently criminalized the entire opposition. They consistently smeared the entire opposition and threatened them, which had the exact opposite effect, and that is it brought all these kind of different political traditions together. It mobilized opposition voters. In fact, many voters who pledged never to vote again, many opposition voters who pledged never to vote again, given the irregularities in the presidential elections last year, actually rushed to the polls. So the voter turnout was around 85%, you know, which is pretty normal given local elections in Turkey. But we have seen high voter participation on the opposition's part. Now, what are the consequences of this kind of radical change of fortunes for Erdogan? First, having lost, over two-thirds of the economic activity, over half the population, 8 of the 12 largest metropolises in Turkey to the opposition, now he has much less opportunity to distribute spoils to his followers through the municipalities. You know, Turkish municipalities are a key source of cash for political parties, key source of spoils for loyalists, and also a key opportunity to build networks and alliances at the local level. So the next time that Turkey holds presidential and parliamentary elections, which now go together, Erdogan will have much bigger challenge to tap into these municipal resources. Second, there is a symbolic side to this, and that is he is no longer an invincible politician. You know, except for a brief hiccup in the June 2015 elections, Erdogan was unbeaten. And having lost, you know, significant urban centers in an extremely uneven, you know, election, shows to the opposition that Erdogan can lose. Even in a rigged election, he can lose. So you can be sure that there will be greater enthusiasm to dethrone him in the next presidential and general elections. Another consequence is, Erdogan has always argued since his ascent to power and as recently as during the last campaign period, that whoever wins Istanbul wins Turkey, whoever loses Istanbul loses Turkey. And Erdogan, at least at the level of the ballot box, seems to have lost Istanbul. And this is, from an economic perspective, from a political perspective, from a symbolic perspective, a massive blow to Erdogan, and that explains why still the recounts are going on. Every single day, Erdogan and his inner circle come up with a new excuse not to hand Istanbul over to the opposition candidate. And we will yet see how Erdogan decides, meaning whether he will go and blatantly steal Istanbul elections, you know, either by, I don't know, sending the mayor to prison or appointing a trustee or holding a re-election, annulling the election that he lost. But it shows that there is now major discord within the ranks of Erdogan's AKP, whereby, you know, some of the moderates would like to concede defeat. Others who have benefited enormously from Istanbul's spoils would like to hold on to the city and the municipality at all costs. And all of this will be instrumental as Turkey now tries to grapple with the worst economic crisis in its history. So what we see last year was a slumpflation, that is double-digit inflation, you know, almost 25% inflation, hand-in-hand with official contraction of the economy. So we have stagflation and hyperinflation combined together, leading to slumpflation. There is also a massive devaluation, almost 30% last year. All of this puts enormous strain on the Turkish government, and Erdogan's kind of strong arm tactics here further exacerbate Turkey's economic woes as global investor confidence erodes, as the business climate is harmed, as potential, you know, brain drain and capital flight, you know, picks up steam. We see that Erdogan's heavy-handed tactics in the local elections could be extremely harmful to the overall state of the Turkish economy. There is, of course, also a foreign policy dimension to all this. You know, I do not expect an immediate shift in Turkey's foreign policy orientation, but something is already in the works, and that is Erdogan, at least since the March 31st elections, seemed to be overwhelmed. You know, by the way, you have to take into account that today's Erdogan is an isolated, kind of tired leader who lacks talent, who is basically, who has imprisoned himself in a narrow circle of sycophants and yes men who have nowhere near the competence of some of his earlier colleagues. And under the enormous strain of micromanaging local elections and local election results, Erdogan now suffers from a bandwidth issue. So there is a lot happening in Libya. You know, I have observed some of Turkey's Islamists lamenting that they have lost Libya. There is a lot happening in Sudan. And again, some Turkish Islamists are lamenting that they are on the verge of losing Sudan. There is a lot happening in Algeria. So, you know, these are all playing fields where Erdogan and his, you know, Turkish and global Ikhwanist, you know, followers have strong interest in shaping. And given that the perfect storm at home, you know, economic crisis on the one hand and the election crisis on the other hand, we see that Erdogan now has much less bandwidth, much less energy, much less kind of proactive kind of enthusiasm to basically meddle in the affairs of all these, you know, polities and countries. So when we add to that the brewing crisis in U.S.-Turkish relations, you know, which is, you know, Erdogan's, you know, strong commitment and reiteration that he will purchase S-400 and even, as he said today, potentially deploy them earlier than the expected October or November delivery date. And again, the Turkish foreign ministers pledged today that Turkey might buy additional S-400 batteries if the U.S. fails to provide Patriots. show that there is still greater room for this crisis, meaning it will escalate further. Yesterday, there was another bill, calling for global Magnitsky-style sanctions against Turkish officials for wrongful detention of U.S. persons, and not only U.S. nationals, but also U.S. State Department employees. And when we put all these together, you know, from Erdogan's hostage diplomacy and pushback from U.S., Erdogan's turn to Russian-made S-400s, and the potential blocking of the delivery of F-35 stealth fighters, as well as pushing out of Turkish companies from the supply chain, as well as the introduction of CATSA sanctions. You know, this certainly looks like a very challenging moment for Erdogan, both at home and abroad. And I think what's crucial to watch here is the fact that all of these different levels resonate with one another, meaning the fact that up to 10 Turkish companies could be pushed out of the F-35 production chain, supply chain, and thereby forfeiting $12 billion of exports would be quite devastating, not only to Turkey's defense industry, but also to Turkey's economy. Now, when you combine that with Erdogan's kind of heavy-handed meddling in the local election results, attempts to centralize power by usurping some of the municipal prerogatives, you know, which will again have a lot of damaging effect on local economies, on local dynamism and incentive taking. You know, this all seems to be moving in one direction, and that is deepening of Turkey's economic crisis, deepening of Turkey's domestic political crisis and potentially triggering social unrest, as well as an imminent kind of crash course in Turkey's relations with the U.S., with potential sanctions on the way. 2019 and 2020 could be for Erdogan kind of a make it or break it kind of year. I don't want to be naive as I end my comments. Erdogan is very resilient. He has enormous hold on all of Turkey's institutions and the media. He has amassed executive, legislative, judicial powers. He still has a solid 50% not only Islamists, but also ultra-nationalists. But at the same time, I would like to highlight that there is another 50% more energized than ever, who now trust that they can defeat Erdogan, who now has the opportunity to prove their competence in Turkey's leading cities, and who increasingly appear to be kind of legitimate stakeholders in Turkey, competent stakeholders in Turkey. So it will be, I think, a very interesting year to watch, both for Turkish domestic politics, but also for repercussions in the greater Middle East. I would like to maybe end with a question and ask whether this might not only be the beginning of the end for the Erdogan regime in Turkey, might this also be the beginning of the end for the remnants of the transnational Ikhwanist kind of Muslim Brotherhood project? Because, you know, following developments in Egypt, now we might be beginning to see the undoing of the other major Muslim Brotherhood regime in the Middle East. And again, I would argue, if that is indeed the case, all the way from, Libya to Sudan, Palestine to Qatar, from the Balkans to the Caucasus, this will have a major effect on the capabilities and efficacy of radical Islamist actors, violent and non-violent kind of radical Islamist actors. So again, I think Turkish local elections were indeed about municipalities and mayors and city councillors, but the ramifications for Islamist politicians globally could be huge. And I would be happy to take any questions you have at this point.
Aykan Erdemir, thank you. That was an amazing look at Turkey. And I'm always happy when a speaker ends on a slightly positive note. One of our listeners wrote in, that's a big statement that this might be the beginning of the end, but it's a very hopeful statement. A reminder to our listeners, if you have a question, we have a number of questions already up, info@jewishpolicycenter.org or Twitter @the JPC. So the first question is, can you tell us something about the secular opposition parties? Yesterday, there was an article in the New York Times that said everybody in Turkey, AK Party and the opposition, they're all right-wing nationalist, nasty people. That was the New York Times. Could you tell us a little bit about the opposition parties? Are they the equivalent to, let's say, European or Israeli center-right nationalist parties?
Now, yes, indeed. Nationalism is a sweeping ideology across the Turkish political spectrum, but it would be, I think, simplistic to argue that they're all one and the same. So my first pushback, for example, to the theses presented in that New York Times article is that Turkey's center-left and center-right traditions do have a moderate dose of nationalism, but at the same time, they stand in stark contrast to what Turkey's ultra-nationalists, the MHP, represent, as well as they also represent a stark contrast in terms of secularism to what the Islamists represent. It is accurate that the Turkish notion of secularism falls short of the Anglo-Saxon understanding of secularism, falls short of, you know, freedom for and freedom from religion. But given the state of, you know, state and mosque affairs in the greater Middle East, this is as close as we can get at this point to building a secular kind of inclusive kind of polity. So I am myself an incrementalist. You know, I do focus on the gray zone because that's often where policy is made. And ultimately, it's like, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good in a way. So yes, Turkey's opposition parties do have shortcomings on various issues, but nevertheless, they do represent a massive improvement to what the Islamist ultra-nationalist coalition could deliver in Turkey. And this is, I think, most important, especially from the point of view of the Turkish citizens on the ground, meaning the elections, even just the change of power from kind of ruling mayors to opposition mayors would have major real life impact on the livelihood of Turkey's secular leaning citizens, but especially for Turkey's ethnic and religious minorities. So I have a yes and no answer to it, but ultimately, where it matters, yes, the opposition is significantly different and offers a significantly improved version of politics that would be worth celebrating.
So you mentioned ethnic and religious minorities. Let me ask you specifically about the religious minority that we are most interested in, and that is Turkish Jews. Will the change, and most of whom are people who live in cities, is the change in the governance of those cities a good omen for the Jewish community?
I would say yes, because even just to give you a concrete example, in Istanbul's sub-province of Beşiktaş, which is one of the major sub-provinces, you know, where CHP, you know, has received over 60% over the years, and has a solid majority. We have seen for the first time in Turkish history, Turkish Republican history, the public Hanukkah celebrations, which were made possible simply by the presence of a CHP mayor in that district. Yes, it's true, the government can always play a spoiler role. And yes, it's true that it did help that government also kind of bestowed its blessings on this public Hanukkah ceremony. But ultimately, what allows a kind of an urban cosmopolitan pluralism and inclusivism to flourish is the attitude of local governments. You know, we have seen, again, a similar development in the city of Edirne, which is run by a CHP mayor, which is on the Greek border. And we have seen the restoration of the town's old synagogue. And for the last couple of years, the Jewish community is holding, you know, breaking of the fast, iftar ceremonies at that synagogue in collaboration with the local mayor, which allows, you know, Istanbul's Jewish community to take buses to Edirne, which for some of them is their ancestral town. And there you see, you know, Muslims and Jews, you know, breaking, you know, fast together during Ramadan with the participation of the mayor. So attitudes of local mayors and city councillors, I think, matter greatly. This does not mean that local communities are immune to, you know, the hate messaging, the hate speech, you know, pushed from the, you know, the highest levels of the government. They indeed are, but at the same time, the local level could provide a cushion, could provide various bridge building and reconciliation practices. So given Istanbul hopefully will now be run by a CHP mayor who has so far demonstrated a very catch-all inclusive attitude to, you know, all, you know, faiths and cultures, I think that there still is a hopeful message there. And maybe the one caveat I would like to introduce here is every time Turkey has a deepening economic problem or a foreign policy crisis, Erdogan has proven to be the mastermind of scapegoating and smearing of minority communities and kind of putting them on the spot. So that is a major risk, and there's very little local governments can do to counter that. But it's, I guess, we'll have to weigh, you know, both of these dynamics in trying to come up with a prediction as to what the future might present for Turkey's religious minorities, and particularly Jews who are at, you know, most risk.
Yeah. The scapegoating, unfortunately, is a function not only in Turkey, but in a lot of other countries. So it is something that people will want to watch. Here's another question. Is there any appetite in the AKP to begin to find a successor to Erdogan? Has it moved to a point where they wonder if he is their future, or is he fully consolidated?
Yeah, that again, is a great question, because we see two dynamics at work here. In the run-up to local elections, there were, you know, quite significant, let's say, there was a quite significant chatter about the possibility of the establishment of a breakaway party from the AKP. And the names circulated were first the former foreign minister and prime minister Davutoğlu, potentially former, again, President Gül, former finance minister Şimşek, again, former minister of economy, deputy prime minister Babacan. So these are pretty much the, you know, the stars of the Islamist movement in Turkey. And the argument before the elections were that they were waiting to see what the results of the local elections would be. And if Erdogan loses, they would take action. Now, we're still not sure whether they have enthusiasm and courage to go forward with that. That chatter is still there. There are also rumors that Erdogan might invite some of his former and relatively more competent colleagues to join him as part of a cabinet reshuffle. I think these are the two paths that now await Erdogan. Maybe three paths would be a better way to put it. One would be, he just continues business as usual. He runs, domestic and foreign and economic affairs with his, narrow circle of yes men, including his son-in-law, who is the kind of the treasury and chief in Turkey, Berat Albayrak. This is path number one, which could be quite disastrous. Path number two would be a cabinet reshuffle, trying to bring in some of the disgruntled AKP notables, both to improve governance and to prevent a breakaway party. And the third could be, regardless of the first two options, whether the dissidents within the AKP can go their own way and kind of have a splinter party. Now, the challenge there is Erdogan has an enormous capacity to smear and criminalize and imprison opposition figures. And dissidents within the AKP are not immune from that. So I think that would pose a major challenge to the emergence of a new party within the AKP. But another option, and this is one we haven't seen much yet, is whether Erdogan voters and loyalists will begin to cross the divide in the country. Because I basically referred to two halves in Turkey. And so far, electorate doesn't seem to cross that boundary much. Like Erdogan bloc loses very little votes to the opposition bloc. So often voters kind of change preferences within the bloc. But now, given the economic crisis, we could begin to see some defection from the AKP voters, maybe not necessarily to the pro-secular CHP, but maybe to its center-right partner, the Good Party, also called the E Party. And that could be, I think, a major risk to Erdogan's kind of consolidation of power.
Okay, more things to look forward to. What is the status, questioner asks, of talks with Kurdish groups, or specifically, are there talks between the Turkish government and the PKK? Are there talks with other Kurds? What's going on in the Turkish-Kurdish at the moment?
Yes, in the run-up to Turkey's June 2015 general elections, Turkey's ongoing peace talks with the PKK have come to an end. And since then, Erdogan and his ultra-nationalist allies have pursued a hardline policy, a crackdown that is reminiscent of the what's now called the Dirty War in the 1990s in Turkey, which was characterized by extrajudicial assassinations, widespread torture and imprisonment, and a almost wholesale denial of Kurdish rights and freedoms. So sadly, although Turkey made quite a lot of progress during the peace talks, a lot of those wins have disappeared by now, and we see a very heavy-handed crackdown on the on Kurdish, political and cultural activity. And one wishful thinking since June 2015, which I'm sure many of you have heard repeatedly also in Washington and in the U.S., has been that once Erdogan wins the next set of elections, he will relax and he will get back to the table. Now, I have always been a pessimist in that regard. I have argued that given the new dynamics of the ruling bloc in Turkey, given the fact that Erdogan has shared a lot of power with the ultra-nationalist right in Turkey, that he no longer has much room, neither room nor appetite to go back to the Kurdish peace process. So my predictions in all the elections since June 2015, including the snap elections of, you know, November 2015, and then, you know, the referendum, and then the 2018 general and presidential elections, and now with the March 2019 elections, was that we shouldn't be hopeful. Erdogan is not likely to go back to the Kurdish peace process. He's too much taken hostage by the ultra-nationalists. And at this point, given the fact that we have an imminent, you know, foreign policy crisis with the U.S. and an economic crisis, I don't see Erdogan feeling that there are any incentives to change course. What this would mean is not only further escalation of the conflict within Turkey, but also this would preclude any modus vivendi to be reached in Syria with the Syrian Democratic Forces and particularly its major constituent element, the YPG, People's Protection Forces, which Turkey sees as one and the same as the PKK. And the repercussions for the U.S. would be, this would then also preclude any modus vivendi with the U.S. in northeastern Syria and would push Turkey further and further toward Moscow's orbit, as we have seen recently with the joint patrols in Idlib between Turkish and Russian forces, as we have seen with the, you know, the Astana and Sochi processes, you know, where Iran, Turkey, and Russia coordinated Syria affairs. So I'm afraid both at home and abroad, there's not much light at the end of the, you know, Turkish-Kurdish talks and peace process.
So how do Turkish people feel about that? Are Kurds a big issue in Turkey? Is Turkey in northern Syria a big issue for the people? Or is that something that sits aside for them from, let's say, economic issues or whatever? Is it okay with the people if there's a resolution, comfortable resolution of Kurdish nationalism?
I think this is one area where Erdogan feels pretty comfortable. When we take a look at the polls, we see that the Kurdish issue, which most people just perceive as the PKK issue, unites, you know, Turkey's non-Kurdish public almost across the political spectrum. You know, with the exception of the HDP, as well as some, you know, let's say one half of the CHP, most voters, and, you know, representing almost, you know, 70 to 80% of the Turkish public, have pretty, let's say, hardline and nationalist attitudes vis-a-vis the Kurdish issue. So it's, or at least it's never a priority. You know, peace talks are never a priority for them. And when we take a look at Syria policy, again, we see that even people who never vote for Erdogan could look at Syria the same way as he does, could look at the SDF and the YPG in the same light as Erdogan does. So I think this is Erdogan's comfort zone. He knows that he can always manipulate this field to reach to voters beyond his kind of immediate circle of supporters. Ultimately, I think, is there any hope for change in that? I think the local elections, in an unexpected fashion, could be won because when Turkey's, let's say, Kurd skeptic or Kurd phobic electorate now looks at the election results, there is no way for them to deny that they have won major metropolitan centers, you know, including the capital Ankara, including the financial hub Istanbul, including the tourism hub Antalya, including the two largest port cities on the Mediterranean, Mersin and Adana. The seculars won those cities thanks to the Kurdish votes. And that, I think, is complicating the thinking about the Kurds. You know, even voters who are skeptical of the HDP, who are skeptical of Kurdish rights and freedoms, could now begin to question, wait a minute, it's thanks to the Kurds that we have won all these municipalities. So I think if Turkey has, let's say, visionary and resourceful politicians, center-left and center-right secular politicians, who use this opportunity to build bridges, to open up the thinking and debate on the Kurdish issue, I see an opening there, and I would like to end at that optimistic note.
I was just going to say, I love it when we get to end a program on an optimistic note. So thank you for the optimistic note. Thank you for your extremely broad and deep understanding of Turkey. I think you've made the situation there, present and future, much more understandable to our people. And I thank you. I hope we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you for having me. It was always a pleasure, as usual.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our call. Thank you.